From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2015 when a staff member for a New York State Assemblywoman filed a complaint against her with the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, known informally as JACOP. The commission is ostensibly an avenue for potential victims to seek justice. And in this case, the staff member felt that he had been a victim of workplace retaliation after he ended a short relationship with the Assemblywoman. Now, he might have hoped to find an even-handed place to turn in JACOP. Instead, as he testified earlier this month in Albany, he says he felt like he was the one on trial. He felt like he was somehow in trouble for turning to an ethics commission. That sentiment is nothing new in New York State. Albany has been plagued by sexual harassers and abusers, and victims have claimed time after time that the proverbial deck is stacked against them. Former Speaker Sheldon Silver had a hand in filling the commission, and victims have feared that the commission is first designed to protect lawmakers. But that might finally be changing. Earlier this month, the Sexual Harassment Working Group testified in Albany and called for real change. Several members of the New York State Senate applauded them, saying it's time for New York State to stop victim blaming and start pursuing real justice. The working group continues its campaign for change, and we've invited them to join us today on Connections. One of the co-founders of the group is Elizabeth Crothers, who attended the State of the Union address this month as a guest of Congressman Joe Morelli. Now, you might remember that Crothers was sexually assaulted when she worked in Albany years ago, and at the time, Assemblyman Joe Morelli publicly doubted her claims and defended the abuser. Well, after Crothers criticized Joe Morelli last year during the congressional campaign, Morelli reached out to try to repair the damage, and Crothers has praised the congressman for his work in this regard. She now calls him an ally for change and an example of how we need to see more change at all levels of government. So let's talk about that this hour. Let me welcome our guests. Elizabeth Crothers is co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group. She's a former New York State Assembly employee as well, and on the line with us. Elizabeth, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's great having you. And also with us in studio is Elias Farah, who is a member of the Sexual Harassment Working Group, an attorney based in Buffalo. Thanks for coming in. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, unfortunately, you know, some of our guests that you're going to hear this hour, in fact, all of our guests, and you're going to hear more later in the hour, have their own stories to share on this, but they're also working together to change a system. And as I mentioned from the outset, Elizabeth, I think people here in Rochester especially were drawn back to your story about a year ago. And I certainly don't want to dwell too much on it, but I do think it's important to talk about how you have seen or whether you've seen much change, because at the time of what happened to you, there seemed to be a protect the system or protect the power, as opposed to this is a woman who says she's been victimized, let's listen. Take us a little bit through what had happened to you.
Well, when I was when I worked in the assembly, and the assembly, for example, the assembly sexual harassment policy, it starts out with calling something sexual harassment or I can't remember the other word they used, but they called it obnoxious. Mm-hmm. And the system was to go through the council to the majority, who was a political appointee, and it was, but regardless of how that any kind of process went, the speaker was the ultimate authority on what happened, including appeals. And so in my case, first of all, there was the deputy majority who reported to the speaker and supposedly investigating the chief counsel, who also reported to the speaker. And it was just at no point, and I was surprised, perhaps I shouldn't have been, but by this, but at no point did there even seem to be a pretending that the process was going to be the least bit objective. My first interview with the Bill Collins, the majority counsel, Speaker Silver called three times during it. And it was just, so it was this ongoing, you know, process of just never quite meeting what I was supposed to do, and never having, the same thing we see in JACOP today, but a lack of transparency for, in my case, for the victim. Meanwhile, the speaker had already made statements of support for his counsel. So it was a very and when I went to the police, it was also, you know, they rightly told me it was going, it would be, so I pressed charges, quite a process. And so what I've, through working with the sexual harassment working group, seen is that while the, what exactly they are doing or what body they use to do it has changed, whether it's a legislative ethics committee or JCOP, which you mentioned, it's the same systemic issues. There's not an independent body free of politics to look at anything. And their first, they are there to essentially protect the institution. I mean, way back when I was in the assembly, Speaker Silver told me my first priority is to protect the institution. He told me point blank. And now it's just a different way of doing the same thing over and over. And so what I'd previously thought was something I wasn't doing right is clearly systemic and goes on to this day. And the hearings was the first turning point I saw.
Yeah, we're going to talk about those in a moment and exactly what the working group would like to see change. Elizabeth, when you were dealing with that, did you have anybody in state government or anybody in a position of authority that made you feel like you were going to have justice?
Well, I mainly, for the most part, I liked my job, and I was, when I went to talk to the speaker, what I wanted was for him to fire his chief counsel, and I essentially, unrealistically on several levels, but that was what I wanted. I wanted him to fire his counsel so that I didn't have to see him, worry about him, do that. And that was what, and I was completely unprepared for what was to follow, which is similar to what you mentioned earlier about feeling like I was all of a sudden the one on trial.
And now, at least this month, we've seen what looks like change, and I guess I want to ask you a little bit more about that, because it's Congressman Joe Morelli who took you as his guest to the State of the Union and wanted to shine more of the spotlight on the work that you're doing. That's pretty different than what we saw about a year ago when he was running, and initially you were expressing dissatisfaction not only with the fact that at the time of your allegations he publicly doubted you, which had to be difficult and painful and might have injured your career, but also that, you know, the question was, what had he done to repair the damage? In your mind now, he's done a lot to repair this damage, you think?
Yeah, I think a lot more than, in the last several months, he's done a lot more to understand and to be active in changing, making improvements for the better than some of his former colleagues who've based their entire 20-year careers on it. So, yeah, I definitely think so. And it was in when I did talk to him, and we had lots of conversations since, and with other members of the working group. And he's made an effort and does actually understand the issues and what would help the issues and help us to accomplish them, spent a lot of time and energy in doing that. And it's one thing that's given me hope that, okay, well, I mean, this is a perfect example of what we really want to see from lawmakers.
Sure, sure. And I also recall a conversation with then Assemblyman Joe Morelli when he was running, and I asked him, I pressed him about these issues related to your case. What he said he wanted to take responsibility for the fact that at the time, those years ago, when these allegations came up, he said he knew the chief counsel, he knew Sheldon Silver obviously very well, and he said he just couldn't in his mind believe that this could have happened. So when he made his sort of condemning remarks in the public, he just thought, boy, there's no way that this could have happened, and that his mindset over the years has moved away from a knee-jerk don't believe an accuser. Do you think society is moving more in that direction that the now congressman says he has moved? In other words, saying, you know, someone, usually a woman, not always, makes a claim, And you know, maybe the old reaction was, well, no way, that person wouldn't have done that. Why would they have done that? Or I'm not going to believe that. Are we moving away from that? And are we moving away from that sufficiently, Elizabeth?
I don't think we've moved away from it because it's really uncomfortable to move away from, because it's really uncomfortable to think that someone we know, either on a personal level or professionally, is capable of doing something like that. And it's I think it's really intensely uncomfortable for people just themselves, and then also how they go about their daily business. So I think until I think reaching the point where there's more social responsibility, more kind of that people aren't so easily influenced by what they thought of a person, and are also willing to essentially to not invite that person to the party anymore, not offer them a job as a lobbyist, not to you know, that there are the social consequences that right still now, as when I was there, the victim feels, but not necessarily the person who is accused of doing something, nor the people who protect them. So I don't think there's been sufficient change, and I think it's difficult, and that's what we are trying to just in talking to people, having them understand better the nuances of the issue and the difficulties involved. And it's about power, and thinking about it in that way, I think it can make probably a lot more sense to people.
Our guest on the line is Elizabeth Crothers, co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group and a former New York State Assembly employee. And you might see on Twitter a hashtag for #HarassmentFreeAlbany. The working group has a website that they've established, not only highlighting the testimony that they gave in Albany earlier this month, but also some of the work they're doing. And Elias Farah is a member as well, an attorney based in Buffalo who's with us in studio. And your story just goes back a few years now to when you were also working for the New York State Assembly. 2015, right?
2015, that's
okay.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about what had happened in your case.
Well, you know, I think I like to go after what had happened. You know, there's a lot of details that go into what actually occurred, but my thing kind of started after. You know, when I tried to go to the assembly with some of the things that were going on with the assemblywoman herself.
You worked for an assemblywoman.
I worked for an assemblywoman.
In the Buffalo area.
In the Buffalo area. She's no longer an assemblywoman, but I worked for her. I went to the assembly. There was nobody I could turn to, and I brought this up in the hearing. I mean, there was nobody, no independent counsel. Everybody that I talked to in some way or capacity worked for the assembly. You know, even people that worked in my office. You know, I very specifically remember somebody saying to me, you know, resign, sign some forms, get out of here, or you'll make things worse for yourself. I tried to disappear. I tried to go away. I spoke to the assembly, and I think at some point, even the assemblywoman's attorney came after me, saying that he was going to bring me to justice, which I'm still not sure what that means. And I know you mentioned the J-COPE investigation. There was another assembly investigation. All of those things after, it made me feel like I was on trial, like I had done something wrong. The various news outlets, I think, turned it into a media frenzy. I know her attorney had gone to the news, UK Daily Mail, I mean, tabloid style papers after this. So my story kind of deals mainly with the retaliation that happened after, but also the fact that, you know, I had nobody that I could turn to. I mean, there was nobody nobody you could ask, no independent legal counsel. I mean, as you heard on the phone there, nobody's really independent. There's no independent body you can go to. I mean, the assembly members have their own attorneys. The assembly is protected by attorneys. But any employee who makes any kind of complaint or, you know, even wants to ask a question about something that it could possibly be a complaint, you can't go to anybody that's really independent. I mean, you can go to your own attorney at a significant cost. I went to an attorney because I didn't know where to go. And I think she asked that I give her $12,000. $12,000 is a lot of money, especially when you don't know what's going on. That's one of the things that I, especially with the working group, that's something that has to change. I mean, that's a huge thing that needs to change. Additionally, the Jacob investigation, I want to get back to that. The assembly launched their own investigation in conjunction with Jacob, and I'm still unfamiliar with what exactly Jacob was investigating, to be honest.
When he says Jacob, again, it's the Joint Commission on Public Ethics.
So I'm very, you know, at some point, the assembly was aware of what was going on. I don't know whether it was from me or from the assemblywoman saying that there may be a complaint. I have no idea how really they got involved. Their process is very closed door. Like I said, you know, I sat down with an investigator. I also sat down with some members from JCOP. It very much felt like I was on trial. I was not sure what they were looking for.
Where did you have to go to do this?
I did it at my attorney's office.
Okay.
I did retain an attorney. I did it at the office. Again, I wasn't sure what they were looking for.
And again, I'm trying to make sure people understand. So when Elias brings a complaint forward in sort of in the realm of sexual harassment, in this case, retaliation over a relationship with a superior, and you're wondering, because anybody in any work situation or any situation in society might wonder, well, if I ever have to be in that position, what is that going to feel like? You felt like you were in trouble for saying something.
And that's not only a feeling that was specific to then. I mean, that feeling's continued on. I mean, even sometimes to this day. Like I said, you know, when the papers came out and her attorney, I think they bound her by the assembly rules, but he came out and said, I'm not bound by anything. I'm an attorney. The assembly can bind her to not speak, but I'll speak all, you know, freely as I want. It felt like, you know, he said he was going to bring me to some sort of justice. And I had people calling me up and, saying, what did you do? What are you going to get charged with? And I said, nothing. I legitimately pursued a complaint. Even when I started my first job out of law school, I started at a DA's office in St. Lawrence County. And second day there, the newspapers came out with an article that, again, made it look like I had done something wrong. I'd been charged with some kind of crime. I think somebody alluded to the fact that I was possibly going to be charged with a misdemeanor or something. And I don't know where any of these things came from other than repeated attempts by people to either discredit me. Even other people associated with the assemblywoman, Michael Caputo, who has worked for the president of the United States, he did a podcast about me, a 30-minute podcast, calling me a creep and saying that I was preying on an innocent mother. All of this in conjunction. So, I can't say that anything ever ended or that retaliation ever ended, because I think once it was started in motion, just based on me making a complaint, you know, so that's why I think the complaint itself, it's hard to say, you know, did the retaliation end? No, it never ended.
So let me ask both of you.
Yeah,
go ahead, Elizabeth. Well, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to add to that, you know, that feeling and the feeling that it goes for me to this day. I mean, going to the hearing was even an intimidating experience. And even after the speaker's chief counsel was arrested 2 years later for raping another assembly employee, I got a letter from the majority counsel for the assembly, a 3-page letter threatening that they were going to break confidentiality, telling me not to speak out. And I hadn't even signed any non-disclosure agreement. And this was one of two letters that was that kind of just intimidation, and it was I didn't ultimately respond to it at all, but it's scary. And then again, remember, this is after he was brought out of the Capitol in handcuffs. They still are giving it a go.
So let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Elizabeth. When we see the hashtag #HarassmentFreeAlbany, we hear about what the working group is doing. You're giving this testimony. You're making sure New Yorkers see what's happening at the state level. What's top of the list for what needs to change as soon as possible? Elizabeth?
I'll go to something I'm not an expert on, but an independent body to go to. Someone who's not a political appointee. New York is very heavily political appointee. And also getting rid of the severe and pervasive standard that means it's a legal standard that is very difficult to meet. And even the definition of employer, which isn't made clear in recent legislation. So, I mean, those are some of the goals that we're going to. And I reaching those goals would mean I could tell someone, yes, you it's better to report than not report, and to not be scared of reporting. Okay. And I don't know if I could do that right now.
Okay, Elias?
Yeah, you know, and another thing, too, is just more hearings. I mean, look at the hearing we had in Albany just recently. That's the first thing in what, 20 years? 27 years. And that was one hearing, you know. More hearings, especially one downstate, but just because of the population. And additionally, another one in Albany, because that's where the lawmakers are. You know, I'd say another one on this side of the state, Western New York area, just because the stars seemed to align for me that day, that I had that day off. Not really off, but I didn't have to be anywhere. I didn't have to go to court. It just worked out. But for many of the people, you know, coming forward is one thing, but they've moved on. They have jobs. They have things. You know, it's not easy to come forward, to take a whole day to drive across the state for the one day that you have to be available. I mean, that's a difficult thing. So more opportunities for people to testify, to let people know what happened to them. You know, hearing people's stories is crucial, because like my story, like so many other stories, they're defined by what the media puts out there, which I would say is not accurate. And that's the story that people get. That's a story lawmakers get. And they're making laws based on either what they read in the media or what they hear, but they're not making laws on actually hearing from the victims of these things. So the one hearing was great. I mean, it was great, but we've waited so long for this, and you get one hearing, and I'm sure that there's more than the people that testified in this state that have been victims of sexual harassment or workplace retaliation.
Can I ask you?
Not even getting through, not everyone even got to testify at the last hearing because there were so many people who wanted to and just had to leave because it was an 11-hour hearing.
But let me ask Elias, because Elias is not only someone who has been through this, as someone who made had to file a complaint against an employer and deal with what happens in the New York State system, and Jay Cope, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, but also now, as attorney yourself, you know, Elizabeth brought up that the standard, and I don't remember the exact language, is something like, you know, it sounds like clear and convincing, or whatever the evidentiary standard is to successfully pursue a claim of sexual harassment or something in sort of that sphere. As an attorney, what standard do you want there to be? And I ask this in as good faith as I can possibly ask this, because we want to be able to investigate and sort of vet claims as best we can with however much evidence we can muster. And we're not always going to have a perfect sort of calibration of what did or did not happen. I mean, certainly the Christine Blasey Ford case is the first example of someone making a claim that a lot of people would find instantly credible. Others might say, and again, I'm not trying to play this both sides thing, but you know, you certainly heard a lot of Americans say, I don't believe her. And absent evidence all those years ago, it was a sort of take someone's word or don't. What standard do you want there to be in this?
Well, I think that's one of the things that's the problem with the, you know, trying things in the media, trying cases in the media, is that people kind of hold it to their own standard. To kind of put it in layman's terms, I mean, just a zero tolerance policy. You know, there's a hostile work environment standard. There's a quid pro quo sexual harassment. To most people, those don't really make sense. But plainly as you could put it, zero tolerance for sexual harassment. I mean, it can come in all forms. What they've said is it has to rise to a certain standard. It has to rise to a certain occurrence. That's just not acceptable. I mean, that's saying that, you know, some sexual harassment's okay, but not all of it, can't be too much. In just plain English, it should be a zero tolerance for sexual harassment. You know, you could get into all the legal definitions and you could argue it for hours. And that's what's been common. You know, we litigate things in the media. We put things out there, especially people who've been accused. Their attorneys like to turn it around on the victims. They look at victim shaming in a way. You know, I've been asked more times than I can count about my sexual history. I think as recently as 2 weeks ago, the Assemblywoman's attorney sent me an interrogatory asking me all my sexual partners since 2010, which has no bearing at all. I mean, I worked for the Assembly in 2015, so I don't know what 2010 has to do with it. And it's the same thing I said in the Jacob investigation. One of the investigators was looking at sexual partners, sexual history. And the only thing that I can say is that just serves to shame you into not coming forward, which has been done for years. People who come forward, they try to look at things in an effort to shame them or to, you know, use something against them. So that kind of standard where we can, you know, say, well, it's not that much that sexual harassment, or you must have been asking for it, or we'll ask somebody else. You know, that's just unacceptable. I mean, we can't keep doing things that way. And we can't keep trying things in the media. We can't have somebody who can go to the media, especially somebody in power, somebody who has power, and clearly elected officials have power. We can't allow them to go to the media and to try it there. You know, as far as having a case out in the, you know, out in the open for people to decide, you don't get both sides.
Back in 2015, did you want your case reported in the media at all?
No, I didn't want anything in the media.
As you know, Politico reported on it, among another. What was that like for you?
It was traumatizing, to be quite honest. I mean, I was in my last year of law school when that was all coming out. You know, people think, oh, it's, you know, you don't know the effect that it has, especially everybody says don't read the comments, but it's very hard not to read the comments. I mean, the comments were just awful. Just horrible comments. I mean, people making comments that later people, you know, apologized to me. People who had met me after had apologized because they said, you know, I just never knew who you were and I just went off I read. You know, whatever I read, I would go off that. But, you know, it's a traumatizing experience. Up until I came into talking with the working group, I would tell you, you know, don't report anything. Never go out and never say anything. Just disappear, fade away. Because the experience—
You would tell other victims that?
The experience that I had coming out of it was so traumatizing and so horrible because of the media, because of, you know, the Assemblywoman's attorney coming out, saying my name to the papers, accusing me of a crime, it seemed, because he said he was going to bring me to justice. I would have said that. I think things have changed in the past couple of years. It did affect jobs. You know, I don't think anybody should be asked at a job interview to tell them about their sexual history, you know, because they're curious what happened. What happened there? Just elaborate on that. You know, that's traumatizing. You get out of law school, you can't get a job somewhere because people are asking you what happened. You know, people read articles. You might not even get a call back for an interview because they don't want that. I think somebody told me, you know, they didn't want that kind of baggage. So things like that. I mean, and I don't think my story is unique. I think everybody in the working group, I was surprised, actually, in Albany because, you know, I got to hear everybody's story. And that was, for some of them, the first time I've ever heard the story. And our stories were so similar in the behavior of people and how we were treated. Although we all had different stories, I mean, the stories were just so similar, you know, because I remember sitting there here and I'm like, wow, that's the exact same thing, the exact same feelings, the exact same emotions. And I'm sure, you know, it's not unique to us either. I think this is pervasive. I think it's everywhere. I mean, I think everybody, it's a systemic problem that I think has been going on for so long that it almost seems normal to some people, especially in politics. So, you know, I would say, you know, it is a troubling experience when you think you're doing the right thing, you're reporting something, and the media frenzy that follows it also can turn around on the person who reports it.
I want to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and welcome Rita Passerell, who is also a former New York State Assembly employee and a co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group. Elias Farah is with us, a member of the working group, an attorney based in Buffalo. Elizabeth Crothers is on the line with us, the co-founder of the group and a former New York State Assembly employee as well here. Let's get that only break of the hour, and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a conversation about what kids can do if their parents won't get them vaccinated. The law is different in different states. We'll discuss the latest on vaccinations, first hour. Second hour, an update on President Obama's foundation's My Brother's Keeper initiative. Talk with you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You'll see the hashtag #HarassmentFreeAlbany on Twitter and in a number of social media sites. And there is a sexual harassment working group that made some real noise in Albany earlier this month and brought some pretty compelling testimony, trying to create a different way of looking at sexual harassment, of listening to people who are making claims, and also just making sure that the people who are sort of adjudicating these claims are not just political appointees who are there to, in the words of perhaps former Speaker Sheldon Silver, protect the institution. So I want to bring in Rita Passerell, who is on the line with us, who is also a member and a co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group. Rita, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
And I know you're a former New York State Assembly employee, and you know, there's a lot of names, unfortunately, in New York State that have become infamous in the last two decades. And unfortunately, Vito Lopez is one of them. Tell us a little bit about, to the extent you're comfortable, about your story, and then we'll talk about the change you want to see, Rita.
Yeah, sure. So Vito Lopez surely is one of these names that has come to be synonymous with the worst of the worst. When I worked at Vito's office in October 2011 is when I began, and almost immediately he began to pressure me on how he wanted to see me dressed. And he did this for every woman in the office. He often would tell us to wear skirts or heels. He would tell stories about women in other jobs who had been good at their jobs, and he would describe them as good at their jobs because they wore a short skirt. In staff meetings, he would tell women what to wear. And in one very memorable case, I remember he told another employee there, next time wear nothing but that scarf. As many abusers do, he tended to have a pattern of escalation. And, you know, he would go along telling people how to dress. And then shortly after, he would start to pressure them to do more, to say, you know, you have to text me and ask me out to go to coffee. And he later on uses that as a defense when he gets, accused of harassment. And after that point, he would escalate even further, pressuring staff members to share hotels with him, asking for staff members to massage his hand in the car. And it almost immediately, when I was working there, it came crystal clear that you couldn't succeed in his office, you couldn't be successful in your career without tolerating his harassment and abuse. And I reported his harassment in December 2011. I was at least the third person to report him to the New York State Assembly for his harassment in a short period of time. And the people I reported him to were the designated reportees. I had recently attended a sexual harassment training. And that's who I called. I had a lengthy phone conversation reporting all the physical. He had grabbed one employee who wasn't wearing a ring. He had purchased him once. And I had heard he had grabbed her and said, why aren't you wearing the ring? You know, so I reported this to the assembly. And at the end of the first long phone call, they said, okay, do you want to make a report? And I said, okay, I thought I had, but tell me how to do that. So they said, okay, you've got to call back and talk to this other person. So I did the same thing. And then at the end of that, they said, okay, do you want to make a complaint? And I said, yes, I do. Please tell me what else I need to do. They told me to send them a written follow-up. Okay, so I sent them an email. And then after the email, they wrote back and said, can you send us a hard copy? And so it was just this you know, ridiculous series of hoops. And only months later, when Lopez came out very publicly in the press, reported how he had harassed women who worked after I left his office, I found out that no investigation had been conducted by the assembly and no protections had been put in place to protect staff members. So, you know, even perhaps most shockingly, well, when The J. Culp investigation that followed this, after all the hoops that I had gone through to report his harassment, the Assembly Council, there's an email that came public in the J. Culp report, the Assembly Council represented that, you know, in a report of harassment required affirmative action, which we just, it seemed that we had not desired to undertake. So in other words, he's saying they never received a complaint.
Never received a complaint?
Right.
Rita, we've been hearing stories like yours. I mean, Elias Ferry, your colleagues, Elizabeth Crothers, your colleagues on the Sexual Harassment Working Group. And for those of us who've never had to make such a complaint, it's hard to relate to just how difficult that would be. What was it like sort of emotionally for you to kind of deal with some of that?
Well, it was really surprising and very, very disappointing. I had made the complaint with full faith that it was going to be taken seriously and protections would be put in place not only for myself, but for others.
Right.
And they just weren't.
And so now...
Yeah, I think that this is...
Oh, no. Go ahead, Rita. Go ahead.
I think that what you've heard from Elias and Elizabeth and myself and what I've heard from others in the group is, you know, this perpetual mishandling of harassment complaints. And I think that, you know, quite understandably dissuades people from reporting. And when people, you know, when people don't have faith in the system of reporting harassment, they're not going to use it. And when they're not going to use the complaint process, harassment is going to fester in the workplace and workers are going to be abused. And one of the changes we're proposing legislatively is to get rid of a defense that currently permits employers to essentially blame the victim and say, if the victim didn't report the harassment, that the employer should be let off the hook. And that's a permissible defense in New York State, and we're trying to get rid of that.
Rita, let me sort of reset for our listeners that the Sexual Harassment Working Group has a website, and I know you guys have been, your group has been active in social media in different ways here. Where do you want people to go to learn more about what you're doing, first and foremost, Rita?
Well, our website does have our policy recommendations. It's harassmentfreealbany.com. And we have, last year, we issued a set of full policy recommendations relating to how investigations should be done. And as Elizabeth had mentioned, neutrality is certainly key in there. Also, some other measures like, you know, amending the definitions in statute and also additional protections relating to victims seeking redress. And we also on the website have our 2019 legislative agenda that sets out our suggested changes, how workers can be better protected. And one of those is the one that I had briefly mentioned, is removing the Sarah-Gareller defense.
I want to ask
that lets employers get off the hook.
But I want to ask all of you, and I'll start with Rita on this. You know, Rita talked about how cases of sexual harassment claims, et cetera, had been, and the word Rita chose was mishandled. And I want to ask if maybe they haven't been mishandled. Maybe this is by design. Maybe what Elizabeth Crothers said that she heard directly from Sheldon Silver years ago was that first and foremost, this is about protecting the institution. And so, Rita, if that is the goal, then maybe this isn't a mishandling of these claims. Maybe this is a designed way of trying to first and foremost protect the institution, even if that's at the expense of others. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the current system and the current state of laws are certainly not protective and that they do operate to protect the employer instead of the worker. That's true. And I think we need to change a lot of the laws before we can change how it works in practice in a workplace.
Elizabeth, do you think that the system really was designed intentionally this way? In other words, that we've never had at the state level a system of ethics that looks in an even-handed way at the claims that are coming forward regarding sexual harassment or sexual abuse?
So, I mean, I would agree with everything Rita just said and add also that without being able to speak to the motives of how it was designed, it is and was designed to specifically protect elected officials, high-ranking staff, to protect the status quo. And I don't think much thought was given to victims at all. It wasn't about a fair process. It was about protecting the institution and the people who are in power.
Elias, how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, think about it. You got people who are making the laws to police themselves. I don't know if that's ever a good situation. You know, all these laws and things that you have in place, and especially, you know, the, say, J-COPE, for example, all of this is implemented by people who essentially are just protecting, I mean, they're protecting themselves. Or at least that's the way that I see it, you know, because, I mean, who made these? It's the people who then possibly could be accused. So it's not an independent body that came up with these laws. I mean, it's the assembly, it's the Senate, to then essentially appoint people and then police themselves. So I would think that maybe, you know, and this is all speculation, that I guess sometimes they do make it difficult to come forward because they also want to protect their jobs. They want to protect their livelihood. You know, and I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I think that sometimes it just happens by design. You have a bunch of people in a room and, you know, as you heard, the main goal is to protect the assembly. And I think for each individual person who's been elected, whether they're consciously or subconsciously doing it, they also want to protect themselves. I mean, I don't think anybody, you know, really wants to put themselves in a position where they get voted out or where they get taken out by an ethical complaint. So, I mean, I would say the system's not exactly designed in favor of victims.
Okay, so I want to hear what you're hearing from lawmakers, because it's one thing to have a day like you had earlier this month. You go to Albany. Our Karen DeWitt reported on it for WXXI and across the state. And there was a lot of powerful testimony that day. And we heard from some members of the state Senate who had a lot of supportive things to say about the work that you're doing. But that doesn't indicate to me that everything is turning, at least in the way that you want them. You know, Rita, I know you've had a lot to do with kind of compiling the list of what you'd like to see happen and some of the specifics here. What did you hear that day, and what are you hearing now from lawmakers about how realistic it is that we're going to see real change?
Yeah, great question. So that day I was surprised in a good way to hear so many tough questions that were asked by a lot of the senators, specifically Senator Biagi, Senator Gnardis, Senator Salazar, and Assemblymember Yulin as well. They were tough on the agencies, as they should have been. They were very pointed, and it was clear they had done their homework on the procedures that J-COPE had been working with and that Department of Labor had been discussing. Department of Labor was up there for several hours speaking, and those legislators were really digging in to see how, in practice, the things that these agencies do are affecting workers. So I think that was a great sign. And I also, you know, I also will somewhat reserve judgment on whether we'll be seeing change or not till the end of the session. I think we'll really know whether that hearing has done much or whether our legislators really have been able to make meaningful changes when we see what bills get passed. And we have seen a number of really helpful bills getting drafted. Assemblymember Simotas and Senator Biagi have several, you know, that are informing people of their rights before settling. Assemblymember Simotas has a bill relating to making a repository with the Attorney General for settlements related to discrimination. And one of the most important changes that we hope to see this year is that there's a National Employment Lawyers Association has proposed a number of changes, and we think that the legislature is drafting them related to the severe or pervasive standard. And that is the big barrier that employment law experts tell us is in the way of workers being treated well at work.
Severe and pervasive, just to kind of hit that point again, that standard for, and I want to make sure I understand this, Rita, for proving or for sort of quote-unquote winning a claim, right, that you can demonstrate that sort of severe and pervasive harassment?
Exactly. So in courts and in the law in New York State, harassment isn't considered sexual harassment unless it rises to the level of severe or pervasive. And this, in practice, is a very, very high threshold, and workers usually fail to meet it, even when there's examples of physical attacks. There was a number of recent cases where workers have been unable to meet this. When there's a 2018 case where, the 2015 case where somebody had been groped several times, the court bounced it saying this is not severe or pervasive. And a lot of the abuse you've heard described by members of the working group, in particular myself and Elias, may not have been, you know, up to that level. Certainly not in the case of, you know, Lopez telling us what to wear. Many times cases like this are dismissed saying this is not severe or pervasive enough to meet the level of harassment. And that's just an unacceptable level of abuse that we're requiring our workers to endure just to get through their jobs. The standard that we're proposing is what the New York City standard follows, which is that you shouldn't be treated any less well because of any, you know, any gender or racial difference that you have at work. You know, it should apply to all forms of discrimination. And that's the right standard. You shouldn't have to go to work and be subjected to abuse.
Okay, so Rita, are you, you're absolutely right when you say you got to wait till the end of the session before you can declare victory or sort of, or signal disappointment, because Albany works in interesting ways. But we have seen in times in the past where lawmakers will quote unquote listen to people who show up in Albany, but it's sort of, hey, you know, give them their spotlight, give them the day, and then move on, as opposed to actually doing the work. Are you an optimist that they're going to pass any or all of these measures, Rita? Do you think it's going to happen?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I think that severe pervasive is coming this year, and I think that the legislature understands that change needs to happen. I think the hearings have highlighted this abuse that doesn't only affect government workers, but the whole workforce. And I think that, you know, there's positive signs that they were listening, not just as our former employers, but as people who have the ability to change the rights of the workers across the state. And I think we're going to see that this session.
Okay, Elias Farah, are you an optimist now?
Well, it's quite hard to be an optimist, but I do think there are some positives coming out now. I'm more of a person who wants to see it happen before I can actually believe it, because you hear a lot of things coming out of politicians' mouths. However, I think it is a step in the right direction. I think just based on the hearing itself, that's probably the best I've felt in years since this all happened. So I think some changes are coming. I'd like to see them happen before I make any, I don't think you're ever done. I don't think it's ever done. I don't think anything's ever going to be finalized or be to the level it should be at. So I think there's a lot of work to do. One thing, too, I wanted to mention, I don't think we got our Gmail out there. So if anybody,
sure.
It's sexualharassmentworkinggroup@gmail. Also on Twitter, harassment_free, for people to reach out. That's how I found the group. So I think it's important to share it. But I think there's a ton of work that still has to be done. And I'm optimistic that people are moving in the right direction. I just like to see where it goes.
Okay. Elizabeth Crothers, how do you feel about what you've seen so far from lawmakers?
Well, I don't know if I would say I'm an optimist, but I'm more optimistic, just like Elias said, I'm more optimistic than I've been in many years. And there's lawmakers who I now, who are there, who I believe what they say, and that they are informed and willing to take political risks to change the system. And going back to the Representative Morelli, like, that's, you know, that has made me much less cynical about the process. So I'll believe it when I see it, as always. But yeah, the hearing was, I think, a turning point for me, and I hope for others.
And Rita, I think it's also important to ask if you think that at least some of the new members and some of the members in the New York State Legislature who weren't there before, if they understand this in a way that, frankly, the Sheldon Silvers of the world and the Vito Lopezes of the world never could. And that's people like Senator Biagi, herself, as I understand it, a survivor of sexual abuse, who might be able to say to you walking in the door, I get it. You have an ally here. Not everybody who's elected to power in New York State is going to just be about protecting power. There's going to be people who want justice here.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, to have the people who are affecting these laws to really understand them. And that what we say is the voices of the survivors in the room when they're making laws. And I do think if somebody's experienced it, it's possibly easier to understand some of the barriers that have been faced when, you know, for example, for reporting, that's hard. And then going on with your job after harassment has happened, that's hard. And so I do have a lot of hope that, people who have experienced harassment or abuse, you know, understand the import of including the voices of other people who have experienced the same.
All right, one more time, Rita, online, where you want people to see more of what the group has been working on?
That's harassmentfreealbany.com, and on Twitter, it's harassment_free.
Okay, and Elias Farah had mentioned an email address that you said you had used to kind of get in touch here, and people may have stories to share or questions to ask. What's the email address, Elias?
It is, sorry, I'm going to get back to it. I just want to
get... You just got
to
get your microphone over there.
Oh, do I have to get back on my microphone there? Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's just harassmentfree. Albany@gmail.com. I think I gave that correct.
Harassment-free Albany.
It's sexual harassment working group at gmail.com.
I was going to do that one more time. Sexual harassment working group at gmail.com.
That's correct.
If you've got more, either your own stories to share, questions to ask about process, or you want to learn more, Elias Farah is a member of the sexual harassment working group and an attorney based in Buffalo. I know to all of you, these are not easy stories to share. I appreciate you being here, and thanks for sharing your time, Elias.
Thank you.
On the line with us, Rita Passarell, former New York State Assembly employee, co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group. I hope we can stay in touch and at least understand what does and does not happen and what changes and what does not change. Rita, thank you for the time this hour.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Elizabeth Crothers, co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group and a former New York State Assembly employee. Same thing, Elizabeth. Let's stay in touch, and I know you'll make sure that we understand what's happening here. Thank you very much for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we will talk to you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.